Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
All right. Hi, I'm Burl Bearer. That guy over there. Mark C.G. Boyer, True Crime Uncensored. Produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. On the phone, Jeff Budget. Hiya, Jeff.
Hey, Burl. Hey, Burl, how are you?
Live and well, much to my surprise. You know,
much to everyone's surprise.
I was thinking about you. I wanted to get you back on the show. You were on here about, 14, 15 years ago. And I figured either you'd gone nuts by now or you've had intensive therapy and you're doing real fine.
Both those are true.
Well, good. We had Hart D. Fisher on 2 weeks in a row. The guy who does American Horrors, the channel with all the horror movies on it. And I always figured that your story would make a hell of a horror movie. People don't know the story if they haven't read your book, Bloodstains, which they should get several copies of immediately. You make wonderful stocking stuffers if they're stalking somebody. You inherited, so correct me if I'm wrong, you inherited somehow your great-great-grandfather's journals. Am I correct?
You know what, Bill?
Yeah?
What I do now when I go on shows like yours, I let everybody know I wrote a book which is fiction based on a true story. And I called it that because there is much I can't prove on it, although I believe the total book.
Oh, gotcha.
I don't go on shows and start getting into whether what's true and what's not true, but I like to explain to you and your listeners what the story's all about.
Well, that's a perfectly fine and acceptable way to approach it. Now, is it true that you inherited somehow your great-great-grandfather's journals?
I don't know.
Okay. Did you ever read the journals that you don't know if you got or not?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I did.
That's important. So I'll tell you what. How about if you give our audience the basic plot outline of the story that you wrote that people have found absolutely captivating, as I have for all these years. And I'm amazed that no one's made a movie out of it yet. So go ahead, tell us the story and what things in it are actually, you have actually experienced physiologically and emotionally.
You know, I will, but let me start with, I loved your opening, okay? I thought that was excellent. I love that. What the mistake I made originally, Burl, when I went on shows like yours 14 years ago, wow, it's getting old, longer and longer, but was I was trying to get into those debates with all the other authors that wrote nonfiction pieces about my great-great-grandfather, about how many he murdered, about what the murder castle, how many levels it had, what functions it had in the basement, how he could turn the remains of a homicide victim into something the Chicago police could not determine what it was, all those things. And to tell you the truth, that's not what Bloodstains was about. And Bloodstains was about a personal journey after an incredible discovery I had regarding perhaps the world's most horrible ancestor possible.
Yeah, that's what struck me about the story.
Yeah, and it's about that journey I went on. It's about those things, learning about those things that I'd known I was different my entire life, okay?
Right.
I was never evil. I was never considering homicide, those things. But my father and I were at a different place than you're supposed to be as a human, and we always wondered what it was about. And as I've gotten older now, Burl, I started to realize, instead of being afraid of admitting those things, I've come on shows like yours now and tried to explain to your listeners that that's what the book is all about. It's about genetics. It's about...
Exactly. That's what I was talking to someone just last night. He said, well, what's your guest about? And I said, I think I may have even put it in the promo for the show today, where I said, you know, is there serial killer genetic DNA? You know, is cannabis be passed on? Or do you obsess on it and manifest it?
Hey, you know what? That's exactly right. And I'm being so relieved lately that people are finally understanding what the story was about. And not, you know, not that they believe in ghosts or things like that, but the journey I went on and the conditions that I developed with, you know, with my doctors, with my neurologists about epilepsy and seizures and voices in my head and things like that, and trying to explain to people that I'm one of the true believers now about how something like evil, something like what makes a serial killer like him come true is possibly passed down. And it's why when you read my book, you'll see it was an incredible mystery about my grandfather, why I never understood my grandfather, why this very stoic, quiet man, very successful in life. He was the boss of one of the... But he used to go on these burrows. He used to go on these fishing trips for 2 or 3 days, and the family would never know where he was. And that part of Middle California, Atascadero, San Luis Obispo, was famous for missing people. And when I learned about who my great-great-grandfather was at that dinner party that one night, I started wondering about, what could have been passed down to my grandfather? Well, which when you set it up properly, H.H. Holmes was my grandfather's grandfather, okay?
Right.
And I started worrying about my grandfather. Then I started looking at my father. Then I started realizing why I was different also in life. And that's what the book is about. That's what I tried to write about. But to tell you the truth, Burl, I was afraid to admit those things when I first came out with the story.
Aha. Uh-huh. So have you revised the manuscript since then?
Listen, when my grandfather died and left me those fishing tackle boxes I write about in the book, you would have been amazed to be there with me when I opened it up to see what was really inside instead of fishing lures.
Was that his murder kit?
No, but it was things my grandfather knew that he hadn't shared with the family about his grandfather.
Ooh.
Things that he hadn't told his wife, my grandmother, her whole life, her whole, you know, marriage. And I don't know if you follow my Bloodstains Facebook page at all.
I tried to go to it. And it says it's been moved. We can't find it.
It's Bloodstains. That's all. It's Facebook Bloodstains.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Okay. That would work. Hey, why don't you start following? I just shared a knife. It's a Sheffield knife from London, the 19th century. It's a folding blade, which my grandfather left in the tackle boxes, which my father gave to me. And guys, now that the world is starting to really, you guys should see this, it's really starting to blossom. Those handwriting compares here, and Holmes' handwriting, which the forensic scientists for the FBI are similar, 98% similar, but they were too afraid to go out on a limb and say it's the same hand. Because they knew that if it was ever proven not true, they'd lose their careers. But now that the world can joke that there's something there, and I started taking a closer look at that knife, that Sheffield knife from the 19th century, and I can't wait for the day when, after shows like you guys or help from the FBI ask very politely if they could take a look at that piece of evidence that may change world history.
Well, I'll tell you, whether your great-great-great, whatever it is, grandfather killed 97 people or 197 or 18, the guy has some severe mental problems. And if they were genetic, certain aspects of illness can be hereditary.
Well, the emotion chip, as you call it.
Yeah.
You know what? That's exact. That emotion chip you bring up is the way to do it, because I don't think he was insane. I think he was evil. And
I'll give
and
you a short.
I think there's a difference there.
From on evil, from my perspective.
Okay.
When it's dark out, it's not dark because there's some dark orb radiating darkness. It's dark because the earth is turned away from the light of the sun. Darkness is the absence of light. Evil is the relative absence of the positive qualities. If one is missing genetically, either by conditions of birth or due to head injuries and abuse, what would be emotion chip, the empathy, sympathy, compassion, etc.
Self-control.
And where it makes no difference whether you're carving a human or carving a turkey, it is not that, it is the absence of what is supposed to be there, either because it's been damaged by the head injury or a birth defect. And like I say, it's not dark because there's something radiating darkness. It's the absence of what is supposed to be there. It's the lack of something, relative lack. The more the lack, the worse it is.
It's interesting, because I've been called a lackey.
Yeah, you are.
Okay.
Yeah. An unlucky lackey at that. Anyway, keep going.
I got a question on
Mark
the knife.
Has a question.
Did you do any research on the knife itself? Where it was made, approximately when it was manufactured?
No, not yet. And to tell you the truth, that's way over my head. I think you're into Scotland Yard, you're into FBI, those things with that.
I don't even know
if it could ever be proven, but when you see it, and when I can guarantee you this, when it comes out that he wrote the Dear Boss letter, all right, and that he cared, that he murdered Catherine Eddowes, at least Catherine Eddowes, when you see the knife, where it was made, when it was made, that the blade that is and would have caused the cuts that were, it'll cross your mind whether it's provable or not that it could be an amazing piece of world true crime history.
In the crimes that he was convicted for here in Chicago, did he target prostitutes and slit their throats, or did he have a different MO here in Chicago?
No, not at all. He targeted innocent young women.
But the Ripper was after the what do you call the women of the night?
No doubt about it. No doubt it. There are some major discrepancies and differences in putting the two stories together. All and gave up on the type of questions you're asking me years ago. But I'll tell you what, when the scientists for the FBI, the ones that do the comparison, come back and say it's 98% the same, you got to start giving it something.
Oh, hell yes. At 98%? 98% is about as close to 100% as you're going to get without
that's
having the nerve
said.
To say 100%.
That's what they said, and they asked me. And they asked me when I did American Ripper with History Channel. You guys remember the show?
Yeah.
They asked me, hey, get History to agree to, fund us reprogramming our comparison computer systems so that we can run that 19th century English handwriting through that ourselves, because we think we'll come back with 100%. And History refused.
Well,
let's try it this way. Did your great-great-grandfather have any kind of surgical or anatomical training? That's one of the aspects that they talk about the most about the Ripper, is that he had some knowledge of anatomy.
What's your first name again?
My name's Mark.
B-R-K, like Mark. Bark, except for them.
Mark, H.H. Holmes graduated from the University of Michigan School of Medicine.
Okay.
Okay, then.
There we go.
And that's not a veterinarian school either.
Well, you have to go through a significant portion of human medical school before you move over to being a veterinarian. In fact, veterinarians train longer than most physicians.
You know how he paid for his tuition?
Murdering innocent women and taking their pocket change?
No, working part-time at a crematorium.
Hmm.
Now, he knew anatomy. He knew how to remove organs from a female's body.
Did he save them?
I don't know.
I thought maybe they were in the tackle box. I don't know.
No, I don't know. It's a lot of fun doing shows like yours now, because I remember 14 years ago how reluctant I was to come out with some of these things we're talking about today. And I was so much into, let's determine how many he actually murdered, all those things. And now I don't care if he killed 5 or 50. He was a terrible, evil monster.
Right.
What I'm fascinated with
is your story of how, I want to know how much you obsessing on this triggered whatever problems you had, or did you see, or have you been treated by neurologists who examined you and said, neural condition, whether it came first or later.
Oh yeah, that's what the book's about me going, experiencing these. They call them seizures. I don't know what to call them, actually. I went and had treatment. I was diagnosed as epilepsy. He'd come visit me and talk to me about his life and my life to come, which wasn't a good thing. And I never saw his face in the seizures. I heard the voice. And the neurologist guys told me that was completely normal for an epileptic. I tried to tell him, whoa, he's telling me things I didn't know before. I worked these facts about his life, you know, about Kyle and why he fired his lawyers and how he's conducting his own defense and things like that. Epileptic seizure, there was nothing ghosty about it. I wasn't being a paranormalist. But I got to tell you, over these years, as I've grown more mature about the story, I got to think there's something a little bit different here. I tried to write about it when my friend Kim Estes and I went down into the post office basement, and I wrote about it in Bloodstains after the post office had barricaded off the basement because their employees all believed it haunted. I don't know if you guys remember, but the United States Post Office at 63rd and Wallace is built atop, a little bit atop, but it's set off a little bit on the same piece of property that the murder castle was once.
Hmm.
And that basement, the employees of the post office had thought was haunted. So while I was on that journey 15 years ago to discover the truth about my great-great-grandfather, I got permission from the superintendent at the post office for them to open up those doors, and Kim and I went down into that basement, and I tried to write about a paranormal experience that I'd had that when I told the neurologist, they told me I was having an epileptic seizure.
Well, I'll tell you, based on my experience, and that's all I can base my life on is my own experience, I see dead people. Always have, and I've always had seizures, but they were just the petite balls, the little ones. But I see dead people.
Burl, don't look in the mirror.
I know. I don't want to see that yet. I've had my brain tested by all sorts of neurologists. Pacific Lutheran University did all those like Ghostbuster psychic tests on me and said, yep, it's well outside the realm of chance.
You and I got a lot in common. I'm so thrilled to hear that someone else understands.
Oh, I understand. It's just part of being in that brainwave. We talked about this in kind of in depth a few weeks ago with Alex Merklinger, who was one of the first people to teach human beings how to voluntarily enter those altered states of consciousness where that kind of information becomes available to them. And he was in a, when he was on the show, he was in a situation with these scientists, etc., saying, you can't teach people to do that. And there's no way a human being can voluntarily produce an alpha brainwave level voluntarily. And he was teaching people how to do that. He brings in one of his students to prove it. They hook her up to one of those brainwave machines, what do you call it, EEG or whatever. And they set it for an alpha wave level, and it's not showing it. They go, ha ha, see, you couldn't do it after all. He goes, wait a second, tune it to theta, which is lower. Bingo, she's producing theta, pure theta waves. You go, oh, I guess you can teach people how to do this. And the guy who was his biggest enemy, shall we say, Elmer Green, finally did a complete turnaround of 180 and became a big advocate of people knowing how to do this, how to voluntarily enter these altered states where that kind of information comes to you. There's nothing woo-woo out of the ordinary. It's just one other aspect of human beings' abilities that simply people long to either don't know how to do it or wants to know how to do it. It just becomes part of your, just like seeing and hearing and thinking. It's just one more aspect of getting input, information, whatever. And you can fact check it if you want to or validate it. And some people think it's strange. Other people, it's just part of their daily life. But if you're not used to it, and I experienced it all my life, and it wasn't until I'm by 40s or 50s when the neurologist decided to study that I found out that not everybody was having these things. So
well, I technically agree, and I am thoroughly enjoying listening to you discuss it, because you know I've had two grandmas in my life. One where I'm being woken up in the back of an ambulance, and they're yelling, "We got him back! We got him back!" That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And but I know that thing. There's an and it's it has, I, you know it's a mental disorder. I understand that, and I'll accept that karma or that characteristic, whatever people want to call it. But I was hearing things from a voice who wanted me to fill his footsteps, all right?
Yep.
And those weren't good footsteps.
And I'm glad you were able to get the information and decide what you're going to do with it. Because there is, I mean, you do have, at least you have, maybe he didn't, or he didn't make the appropriate choices. Maybe he didn't know he could. What are you going to do with that? You know,
Well, I'll tell you what. When you read Bloodstains again, because I'd like you to, you guys. But when you read it, you'll see that I, for the first time, I actually understood my grandfather, who, this quiet, stoic man, had the same things happening in his life, and he had controlled the choices.
Right.
And you know what? Same with my father. And I actually think there's something there for, I don't know, criminal psychology, forensic psychology, to use about this thing that evil men like that have passing it on with genetics. And they should use it, the knowledge that they could gain. I was on Facebook today, Bloodstain, telling people, you know, if you ever want to read true crime, the mind of a killer, an autobiography that Holmes wrote while he was in prison awaiting execution. It's incredible.
Yep. You know, it reminds me of Robert Lee Yates, the Spokane serial killer, who I'm getting a plug for one of my own books there, Body Count. And all the records and everything of his trial are sealed. And he wouldn't talk to me. He wouldn't talk to anybody. He says, why would anybody want to talk to me? You know, he had always been like that. Going back, I mean, they figured that even when he was in Germany, he was probably bumping people off then as well. there was something that he would get into and kept making excuses or, you know, whatever to continue in that path and would give into it. And there are other people that would go, nope. Example for you here. Pedophiles. You say someone are all girls or boys or both. 99.9% of people affected with pedophilia never do anything wrong. They have the thought, they have the inclination, and the public image or the imagination that people have about that is that they're all doing that. And so they don't even want to go talk to therapists about it, but they don't act on it. They choose not to because they know it's morally reprehensible.
But well, yeah, and I, you know, and, but I got, you know, I've realized for myself that I wasn't born with a choice. This was what I got. And if I can use this knowledge to maybe give advantage to the people that are out there trying to predict the next time it happens like that to save some lives, I think it's very valuable.
It is valuable. That's what I think is so. That's what I keep saying, you know, because you know how true crime authors are considered by some, you know, evil bloodsuckers. You know, no one says that about TV reporters or newspaper reporters.
Yes, they do.
They do. But if you spend a year or more, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, researching and writing about crimes or criminals and put all that into an in-depth book, because why, you bottom feeder trying to make a living off other people's suffering? No, that's not the idea. The idea is you're trying to save lives. You know,
I just took a quick check, and recent studies in the last 10 years have shown that inheritable traits that can be passed down that can give somebody increased aggression, or as they call it, the a lack of empathy and emotion.
That lack of empathy and emotion is key.
Yep.
That's where I always knew I was a little different than other people.
So there is a website, I mentioned this on the air before, there's a website for sociopaths run by sociopaths. And the only reason I found out about that is because they went out of their way to give a very bad review to a short story I had written from this from the point of view of a psychopath. And they said they were pointing out inaccuracies in my portrayal. But one fellow on the website said, I don't do any of the things, negative things that sociopaths do, even though I am one. He says, because I learned at an early age that if I do those things, my life will be unhappy. And I'm the only person that I care about. I don't care about anybody but me. And I don't want to be unhappy. I don't want to have a bad life. So I purposely do not do bad things to other people. And they say if you can reach a sociopath or a psychopath prior to the age of 14... you can teach them how to have a happy life without screwing over other people.
You know, I there's a part of me that tends to believe that Holmes loved his life.
Well, he probably reveled in it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can get, you know, you get accustomed to things and then you derive pleasure from them. Like, you know, like they say about hypochondriacs, they enjoy poor health. Or as Mark was talking about a few weeks ago, about trauma. You know, you have horrible traumatic experiences that you're unhappy about, and you could wind up so comfortable in your misery that it becomes embedded in your identity.
You become so comfortable that you can't imagine feeling any other way. And the prospect of feeling any other way terrifies you.
Could be very well be. I was trying to write this morning, you know, on my post about how I'm really disappointed how, you know, criminal psychology hasn't taken the chance. I know they study some of the other serial killers, the one in Seattle, the one in Chicago, you know, the terrible ones, the horrible monsters. And I think Holmes is the one they should take a closer look at. And he's written books. He has the trial transcript. He has confessions with newspapers, hundreds of them. And they could find so much information about what was going on. And I understand that whenever I bring that up on other shows, they always want it. Well, he was a pathological liar. He never said the truth. And I said, yeah, I know that. But that doesn't mean you can't learn from what he's saying on that piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. I found through entertainment and literature, this kind of discussion evolves or brings out these issues. You know, do you think that Hannibal Lecter was insane, pathological, or what we're talking about?
Oh, yeah. That Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter is right there.
Yeah, well,
right there.
Yeah, we first meet him in Manhunter, you know, with William Peterson. And, he's just there as a side character in that one. There was also Kevin Spacey in Seven.
Yeah.
But the one that really sticks in my head after all these years, 1970.
That.
I seriously doubt they could make this episode on television now, at least broadcast television. Basically, a family that you could call hillbillies, a family of drifters, come to Hawaii for a vacation, and their method of taking care of their life is taking menial jobs, killing the owner, stealing as much cash as they can, and moving on to the next menial job and killing, and they. The story watches them as they go from murder to murder to murder just so they can pay their hotel bill and live. When McGarrett finally catches them and finds out that they've been doing this across the United States for years, 150 or more murders through their career, and he asks them, how could you do this? And the mother of the family looks at him and says, they're not kin. And that's how the episode ends, right there. And that's always disturbed me.
Well, I think you know what, I'm going to have to look that one up. You'll have to help me what episode that is.
I got that here. It's One Big Happy Family.
Ooh, what a title.
Season 6, Episode 4 from 1973.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not kin. You know, if they're kin, maybe
they're not kin. Yeah, they're not family, which means that everyone who isn't family is worthless.
Yeah, carve a turkey, carve a person.
Yeah,
you know, they draw the line at one point. Someone had to give them that line to draw. You know, but
I tell you, when you guys take a closer look at Holmes and his life, you'll see that his livelihood. His income source was very close to this, guys. He specialized in defrauding life insurance corporations by murdering, substituting the body, and then collecting the beneficiary resource from the policy.
Hmm.
That's what his lifestyle was built on. He was a wealthy man. And back then, you know, $20,000 check, that was a nice chunk of change.
Oh, hell yes.
And that's how he made his living.
Yeah, everyone's got to have a hobby.
Oh, jeez.
But think about how hard that would have been to be successful at that. An insurance company, they'd be sending out Pinkerton detectives. They'd be ticked off.
We have a pooch arcing.
Maybe just give it a kickback to someone at the insurance companies.
Yeah. Anyway, take a closer look at that. You'll be amazed at how good a criminal he was.
He was obviously very bright.
Oh, he's brilliant. He was the evil genius.
Now, just think, if he didn't have that birth defect or that genetic anomaly, he could have been doing wonderful things.
Did you guys watch any of American Ripper?
Did you happen to catch that?
I may have. It's been a while. I don't remember.
That was the history miniseries, 8 parts that I co-hosted with Amaryllis Fox, the ex-CIA agent, and we ran down whether Holmes could have been Jack the Ripper, with based on what history believed, to tell you the truth. But the last episode was about, I talked them into exhuming the grave at Holy Cross Cemetery where Holmes was reportedly buried.
And
I had to get consent from the court, state of Pennsylvania court had to give consent. My family had to give consent, all those things. Lots of legal fees, lots of expenses. But that last episode is all about us digging him up. And actually putting my hand on that skull.
Wow.
Like Hamlet. And I'll tell you, that's an interesting, when we had the body up and they were doing the DNA, they were doing the dental comparisons, they were doing the trauma, seeing if they could find the official cause of death, trauma to the neck where a hanging was supposed to have occurred, all those things. It was at the University of Pennsylvania in their labs. These were the anthropologists that the judge appointed to conduct the investigation. And one day, I'd always had that scene from Hamlet in my head where he runs down and talks to the skull.
Yeah, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well.
Yeah, that's stuck in my head for a long time. So I snuck down into the lab while they were all up having lunch, the film crew, everybody. And in the dark, I grabbed the skull, held it in my hand, and talked to it, right? And that was the first time, guys, that I knew it wasn't Holmes. You know why?
Didn't talk back.
I got nothing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If it was him, he would have talked back.
He had done something, and I got nothing. And then we started looking at the DNA wasn't a match. The dental records were fake. There was no official cause of death, trauma to the neck where the hanging was supposed to occur. And one of the anthropologists even admitted to me off camera that it was too short to have been Holmes. But then history, of course, said it was Holmes on American Ripper.
Yeah. Well, that's like when... Finally, after all those years of saying that Adolf Hitler killed himself, you know, in the bunker. No, actually, that was a body, was another woman.
There's some strange things in world history, isn't there?
Yeah. That's why you got to go back and revise.
Yeah. Oof. Can you guys do me a favor here? What I did the other day was I had a bunch of my fans, now that they're starting to consider, to understand this Jack the Ripper connection with the handwriting, they were asking me for some signed copies of Bloodstains, and I've been sold out for years. I think we sold like 17,000 copies self-published. And so I got the printing company to print me up a couple more boxes that my fans wanted to have signed, because they were starting to consider this Jack the Ripper possibility, and my signature on the book was intriguing them. So I agreed, and I've got a couple boxes just came in the mail. So if any of your listeners would like a signed copy of Bloodstains, I have a few left.
Heck of a deal.
So how do they contact you?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's an expensive deal because having a printing company that does deals in thousands, print out 50 books is not easy. And then the postage. So the book is $55 for me to sign it. But if they send me a personal check to 10416 Willamette, Willamette, Place, Las Vegas, Nevada, 89134, I'll get one in the mail to them signed.
Heck of a deal. And right. You know, here's something else you can do. If you have the book available as like for on Kindle, you can have...
Oh, yeah, it's there.
You can have your Kindle signed. Did you know that?
No.
Yes. KindleGraph.com. You can... I do this for people. They get a Kindle edition of one of my books. If they want it, the Kindle edition signed, no problem. And there's no printing cost involved.
Yep. But you know what I tell people? I said, listen, I'll sign the book with the same hand that held that skull in my hand. Yeah? They like that.
Well, another thing you can do, if you want to open yourself up to it, is you can have him, through you, sign the book.
Now, that would be... How would I do that?
I could... Maybe when we're off the show or tonight or something.
Do a little channeling?
I'll tell you how to do it. It's real simple.
Okay. People don't realize, but there's 100 million Americans that believe in the paranormal.
Well, I think the paranormal is mostly perfectly normal. If you take the superstition and the woo-woo out of it, I used to teach these classes, weekend seminars, Psychic by Sunday or Your Money Back. And getting people to read minds and do all that sort of stuff was the easiest thing to do. You could have them doing it within the first hour of being in the class, and they were drop-jawed that they were doing it because they didn't plan on it. Easiest thing in the world to have happen. All you got to do is be in the 8 to 13 cycle brainwaves, alpha state, same state as you're daydreaming.
Okay. That's fascinating. I got to tell you, Burl, I'm excited. Now, Mark, too, I'm excited about you guys reading that chapter in Bloodstains about when my friend Kim and I went down into that basement and what that voice wanted me to do to Kim. And I write about it in the book. And I'm convinced that if we ever had a professional team go back down there with us and properly recorded, properly filmed, I'm convinced that will be the place that the paranormal is proven true.
Well, I'll tell you, it's not a matter of physical place or physical time, because space and time in those brainwave levels don't matter, don't exist. The time is not linear anyway.
It sure was different for me that day.
Yeah. We'll get together on the phone maybe tonight, whatever, and I'll teach you. It's real simple. I'll teach you how to, if you want to do it, on purpose, to connect with what you were doing involuntarily before, and say, okay, sign the book. You can do it. I'll teach you how.
You know, I'm gonna do that with you. I'm also excited to hear about you. You considering how ridiculous it was that Hollywood never wanted to make a movie. I one of my favorite television series of all times was Dexter, okay?
Yeah.
And this done right is Dexter times 10, if you ask me. The Dexter thing had to go into him being a good person and not wanting to kill a bat, all that stuff. And it got a little silly there after a while, but when it started off, the foundation and the basis for that story and that series was always something I found fascinating and had to do with that passing the genetics on to the next footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when it got to the point where he was investigating his own murders, kind of lost me.
Yeah, me too.
Although in real life, this was in France, there was a convicted criminal who wrote a true crime column for the newspaper. And there was a series of murders And so he began investigating them as part of his job there as the true crime reporter or whatever, commentator. And he caught himself. He was the one doing it.
He caught himself.
Yeah.
Wow.
True story.
So he didn't remember he did that?
Oh, no, he did. He just thought he could investigate his own case and get away with it.
Well, you know, you write about what you know.
Yeah, write about what you know.
You almost had to have Stephen King writing that one.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, we were teaching at the Washington State Penitentiary, and Alex was also teaching in California Department of Corrections at the women's prison here. We had some interesting responses. The idea was to reduce recidivism by having these guys, teaching these guys how to get in touch, you know, themselves and do some changing of their own self-image and maybe being able to make those decisions to respond to impulses rather than reacting to them. You know, I would tell people, pretend you've got a remote control like you do with a TV, and the impulse comes, you hit pause, reflect, make your decision, and then hit play. You don't just automatically react to the impulse. Hit pause.
Well, that's much harder said than done. We had a guest on, Frazzle Brain.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the subconscious scripts.
Right.
That do not present themselves consciously to be altered. And, simple stimulus response.
Right.
Triggers those scripts, and then the reaction flows.
Correct.
And there is nothing cognitive about the reaction.
That is why we would teach people how to voluntarily enter these altered state of consciousness with a trigger mechanism, very simple. And then the brainwave levels would go down. Just like, you ever have trouble remembering something? Like, oh, the name of that person in that movie? And the more you try to think of it, the less you can. The minute you give up
and relax,
the brain waves slow down, bam, the information's there. So we would teach people how to voluntarily, anytime they want, enter that alpha brainwave or theta brainwave state where the imagination, comprehension, memory, etc. is. And that's when they can make those choices. That's when it's a subconscious trigger that if they're in a, like you just said, Mark, if they're in a, you know, outer cognitive state, they just automatically react. But if you know how to voluntarily enter that more relaxed, altered state, that's when you can hit the pause button and choose your response. And once people realize they can choose their response, it gives them a greater sense of direction, goal setting, control of their lives. And they can choose not to be criminals. Except there was the one guy who came up to me after a class and said, "Thank you so much, Mr. Bear, on teaching about personal responsibility and making decisions. And I've decided the next time I do a bank job, I'm doing it all by myself."
There are two individuals that I'm aware of. One was Bradshaw with his homecoming series. A psychologist talking about these scripts and how to recognize and how to reprogram them for positivity. L. Ron Hubbard in his book Dianetics talks about the reactive mind. It's the same concept. And the book is trying to teach you how to recognize them, where they come from, why they're there, and how to reprogram.
Yeah, same thing with Alex Berkeley, his forthcoming book, The Promise, Psychic by Sunday, where he actually puts in the techniques. Here's what you do to do that. So like, you should be able to do this. Here is actually step by step how anybody can do this. And so I'm eager for the book to come out sometime this year.
Step by step.
Slowly
I turned.
You familiar with that old Rudy? Slowly I turned. Inspired.
Niagara Falls.
I was the significant other of the widow of Joey Faye, who was the comedian who wrote that bit. And I actually had my hands on the original typed version that Joey Faye himself, when he wrote that bit, I had the original. And I made copies of it and donated them to the Hollywood Library or something. As a bit of history. So now, does anybody approach you about film rights to Bloodstains?
Oh, History wanted to buy the rights to Bloodstains for a while, but we had some problems getting along, and I told them no. But what always amazed me, guys, was how at one point Tom Cruise, DiCaprio, Scorsese were interested in The Devil in the White City.
Yep.
And then they backed off. They backed off. I think they started getting worried about how the legend and lore had it that he'd murdered 200 people or something. And anyone with any reasonable, historical insight knew that number was too much.
Oh, yeah, well, there's some serial killer guy who has confessed to like 400, and we know that 399 of them are BS,
Yeah, I mean, there's no, it just doesn't, but then you go to the police records in Chicago at the time, and they'll admit they've got 30 or 40 people they can't account for. They went missing around that area.
And hey, you know what? You know what's missing right now?
What?
Time. This hour is just spent by Bloodstains by Jeff Mudgett. You can get an autographed copy for about the price of a teener.
Yeah, get the price of four, a couple of lattes. Why don't you give that address again real quick?
All right. And 10416 Willamette, Willamette Place, Las Vegas, Nevada, 89134. Make the check out to me or money order. And I'll give me your address. Let me know how you'd like me to personally sign yours. A lot of people want the date and number. And I will do that for you and get it in the mail.
Fantastic.
Excellent, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, great. We'll have you again, and I'll talk to you later.
And you guys hang in there. The story's coming out. Now that the DNA has been proven not to have matched, that he walked away from Moyamensing Prison a free man and lived out the rest of his life in California.
Hey.
Fascinating stuff.
Good place to live. Thanks again. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Hey, Mr.